All right, well, the big news, if you follow the news this week, was, of course, the sad news of about Arnold Schwarzenegger. And as tragic as that is, I think probably the most preposterous thing I saw in the news this week was Arnold getting up and saying these words, "Maria and I love each other very much." When I heard those words, I thought, everybody's going to go, "Ah!" Now, he means something by those words. In his mind, those words have some meaning. But they sure don't mean the same thing to Maria as they do to him, and they don't mean the same thing to most of you or to me as they do him. In our culture, by way of review, in the series Love Dear, this is week four, what our American culture has been taught for about 50 years is that love is what the Greeks used to call eros. It's passionate love, feelings of love, that if you have these strong, passionate feelings, then you're in love. And if you don't have those strong, passionate feelings, then you're not in love. And so love kind of goes up and it kind of goes down. But that is the quintessential view of love. And one of the songs that has sort of typifies this kind of thinking is this one.
It makes me just feel like crying, 'cause baby, something beautiful found in you. Lost that love feeling. Oh, that love.
There's our culture right there. And probably most of you knew the words of that song. That has been ingrained in us for a long, long time. Eros. Now, if you define eros that way, then part of what that, or love is that way, then what that's going to mean is you're going to expect that you're going to feel these strong feelings for your spouse or your friend or whoever, but eventually you're going to run across a wall that is as solid as that wall there, and that's the what about me. Eventually your feelings of love are going to diminish, and you're going to put some type of pressure on your boyfriend or girlfriend or spouse to somehow relate differently to you like they used to, so that you can feel those feelings of love again. As soon as you start putting pressure on your spouse or on your boyfriend or girlfriend, you make eros less likely to occur. One of the other words for love in the Greek is agape. It's a type of love that the Bible invented. It is a selfless love. It's a love that's going to give no matter what. I am going to be a loving person regardless of the response of the person I'm married to, or boyfriend or girlfriend, regardless of the response of my mother or father to me, my brother or sister, even that irritating little brother. I am still going to be a loving person. Now, that kind of love is very elusive. It is so hard to put together. All of us yearn for that kind of love, but it is so hard to put together that in our culture, about 10 or 15 years ago, our culture had a little bit of a shift about what love is, and it's typified by this song. You know, there are sometimes I'm glad I can't hear what some of you are saying. And it's sort of coming from this general direction is what I'm picking up. Everybody thinks they want eros, and they're pursuing that. But when eros diminishes, we still hunger for some kind of love. But this kind of love is so hard to get. It's so hard to experience that we just sort of throw up our hands and settle for an alternative and still call it love. Greg, come on up. As we've been looking at over the these weeks, one of the things we've been looking at is God's kind of love, agape love. And agape love is something that starts with God himself. God says, I am love. He is love. That's just the nature of who he is. And he is going to love his people regardless of their response. It is something that he does. He acts day after day after day, minute after minute after minute in your life and my life, even when you don't think he's acting in a loving way. But he is building something, trying to build something in you, much like an artist builds or paints a painting. Now, one thing that's pretty interesting, Greg. Yesterday, Justin and I were riding our bikes early in the morning, and we were finishing up right along the bike path down here. And Justin said, hey, look, Seth, there's that palm tree. There's that palm tree that Greg's painted. I looked up, and I thought, man, that's it. Yeah, that was pretty cool. All right, now what is different this week than last week?
Foreground on the right, and I don't know if you guys can see it from the back there, but there's some blue, which is the thing that intrigued me about the palm tree.
Okay, and talk some more about the blue.
Well, from an impressionist perspective, shadows at the right time of day go blue. Sometimes they're warm, but this time of day they're blue. And it's just a cool thing.
Okay, so you can see some more texture coming in, some more color coming in. Anything else that that you want to make a note of here? Did you add the houses this week?
No, they've been there.
They've been there, okay.
I'm thinking I need more houses. What do you guys think?
All right, well, thank you, Greg. All right, today what I'd like to do is talk about married love. Up until now, all the principles we've been talking about love, have application in every relationship in your life. Brother, sister, mother, father, parent, child, parent, grandparent, kids at school, friends. But today I want to hone in on marriage love. And Malachi, too, has some very interesting words to describe, give us some context about marriage. Another thing you do, the prophet says to the people, you flood the Lord's altar with tears. You weep and wail because he no longer pays attention to your offerings or accepts them with pleasure from your hands. In other words, the prophet is saying, you guys go to the temple and you pray and you bring your offerings, but I can tell you, God is not interested. He has shut the door because there's something else that he wants you to get a hold of, even though you are crying and pleading with God to hear you. Next verse. You ask why? Why has he shut down heaven? Why is he not listening to our prayers? It is because the Lord is acting as the witness between you and the wife of your youth, because you have broken faith with her. Now, this phrase, broken faith, occurs three times in this passage. It's a very important phrase. You have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. Partner is an important word. It's the word we looked at where it's two corners of a box. You don't have a box without those two corners. When God made them male and female, he made some creatures very, very different than each other that are meant to, by design, learn to coexist and work together. That's all that in that verse 14. Next verse. Has not the Lord made them one? In flesh and spirit they are his. And why one? Because he was seeking godly offspring. So guard yourself in your spirit. He's going to tell them this twice in our passage. In light of all this, guard yourself in your spirit and do not break faith with the wife of your youth. Verse 16. I hate divorce, says the Lord God of Israel. So guard yourself in your spirit, second time he says that, and do not break faith. Now there are three things that I want to just highlight from this passage today. The first is covenant. A covenant is not just two people standing up and saying their vows and saying, I promise to do such and such. I promise to love you and respect you and love and cherish you till death do us part. A covenant in the Bible is a lasting agreement, usually that was sealed by some type of blood. It was a serious commitment before God and before people. Very different from most marriages that you look at. And here, three times he says, do not break faith with that covenant. Now, it's possible to break faith with that covenant outwardly. We saw that in the news this past week, sadly, with Arnold and Maria. But he says, do not break, or guard yourself in your spirit. And the idea here is you can break faith inside without nobody knowing it. And that's the first sign of the breaking of the covenant, when in your head you begin to entertain thoughts about somebody else that should not be entertained. The idea here of covenant is, God, as I get married, I am bringing everything of who I am to you, to be used by you, to be a blessing to the woman you've given me. That's my central agenda in this covenant. The second word is the word context. Marriage has a broader context. It is relational, husband and wife. That's how we typically think about it. But it also has a societal. It's part of society. And part of what marriage is two people coming together to say, we are going to add some stability and security through our home, through our family, in our neighborhood. We're going to provide some stability and security in our church family, through our family. We're going to provide some stability and security on my softball team, or at work, or in my extended family. There's a societal aspect to this. And there's also a spiritual aspect to this, that I am taking this on as an assignment from God. And one day I will answer to him about the kind of husband I've been. It does not matter what kind of wife my wife is or was or will be. I will not stand before God someday and say, you know, God, I would have been a better husband if only Mindy had done but and had my list. That's not going to fly. He said, Seth, I don't care about what kind of woman she is. You're standing here, and I want to know what kind of man were you? What kind of husband were you? That's context or commitment. The last one is companion. And here, the scriptures are clear that the design is for male and female to come together as very, very different creatures and learn through a long learning curve, and sometimes a very difficult learning curve, how to work together. Male and female come at things from totally different perspectives. We see life very differently. We see relationships differently. We see what's important very differently. Our values are different. We communicate differently. Our needs are different. Our desires are different. Just virtually all the important things are different. And that's by design. Because when we learn how to utilize each other and to learn to cooperate with each other, we have something much more powerful than if we did apart. There is a big learning curve on this. It takes a long time. This comes very easily. It can come and go, but it comes very easily. This does not come easily. This is something that has to be built over a long period of time, and this is kind of cool. It's also an investment. And paradoxically, it's an investment that comes back around to benefit not just the people in my life, but it also benefits me in some way. Agape is something I build. Agape is something I also get to enjoy if I have been investing myself toward that. There's a great little movie clip that picks up this element right here. It's from Fiddler on the Roof. Tevye is about to give away three of his daughters to marriage. It's a very different culture. He's just announced to his wife that he's given permission, and she's kind of irritated at him for not talking with him about this. And suddenly he has a question that he wants her to answer is, do you love me? Let's watch this clip.
Golda, do you love me?
Do I what?
Do you love me?
Do I love you?
Well?
With our daughters getting married and this trouble in the town, You're upset. You're worn out. Go inside. Go lie down. Maybe it's indigestion.
No, Golda. I'm asking you a question.
Do you love me?
You're a fool.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love you?
Well...
For 25 years I've washed your clothes, cooked your meals, cleaned your house, given you children, milked your cow. After 25 years, why talk about love right now?
Golda, the first time I met you was on our wedding day. I was scared.
I was shy.
I was nervous.
So was I.
But my father and my mother said we'd learn to love each other. And now I'm asking, Golda, do you love me?
I'm your wife.
I know. But do you love me?
Do I love him?
Well?
For 25 years I've lived with him, fought with him, starved with him. 25 years my bed is his. If that's not love, what is?
And you love me.
I suppose I do.
And I suppose I love you too. It doesn't change a thing, but even so, after 25 years, it's nice to
just a short word to a few of you men that what I've talked to. If I've ever talked to you about a woman and her doing a trial balloon, and what you're supposed to do when you get that trial balloon, you just saw a great example of that. That was a man in relational pursuit of his wife, in spite of a lot of feedback that was not all that encouraging. But eventually, it got to her heart. Now, agape is very different from our culture that says, we love each other so much, and here we go, we're going to ride this wave as long as we can, as long as this wave is still going. And the inference is that when the wave kind of finally peters out, better find the new wave. That's very different from agape. On the inside of your handout, building agape love, there are a few particulars I want to highlight. 1 John 3:16 says, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for our brothers. When we think about agape love, it always starts with God. And the greatest picture here is the willing, loving death of Jesus Christ for you and me. Agape is sacrificial. It's what one of the things Scott mentioned earlier. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for others. And then Titus 2:3 is a verse for you ladies. Likewise, teach the older women to be reverent in the way they live, not to be slanderers or addicted to much wine, but to teach what is good. Then notice this next verse. Then they can train the younger women to love their husbands and children. Then they can train the younger women to love their husbands and children. Now, if you're a young woman, it's very possible you're saying, what do you mean? I don't need training. I don't need training how to love my husband or how to love my kids. I already know what to do. I already love him and love my kids. Now, that may be true in one aspect, but here what Paul is saying, there's a whole other aspect to here where you do need training. And we guys need training too. If you assume I don't need any training in how to love my husband, you are starting in kindergarten. One of the greatest things you can do if you're a young wife is tag along with a veteran wife and listen very closely to some of her stories. It involves a love that is sacrificial, Not just a love that comes because of feelings, and I'm going to ride that wave. 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient. It's kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It is not rude. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Agape love acts and speaks in the other's best interests. It is not thinking about its own interests. It is thinking about the other person's interest and what their best interests might be. That is not the message that our culture is telling you these days. Our culture is driving home to you. You have needs, and you need to stand up for your needs and assert yourself and spell those out crystal clear and demand that those needs are met. That's the message our culture tells you. You try doing that in marriage, good luck. Agape is the absolute opposite of that. And then love is a choice. Love is a choice. There are big choices in love. There are a lot of little choices in love. Every morning, I am usually reading my Bible when Mindy goes off to teach at school. Now, I enjoy it if she comes into our little garden room where I'm reading and says goodbye. I like that. That's pretty cool. There are times when, though, she's in a hurry, and to expect her to come in and say goodbye when she's in a hurry is not a loving thing to do on my part. Now, sometimes I will get up if I know she's in a hurry, and I will beat her to the door to tell her goodbye and to give her a kiss. I am certainly trying to make eye contact with her and through my eyes do something what you saw Tevye do with Golda. There's a light for my girl in that. But there are other times where it would be a self-centered thing for me to do to get up and run to the door when I know she's really, really, really in a hurry. She needs that freedom not to have to come in because I'm so needy to come in and tell me goodbye. Love sometimes is down to those little fine points that has to do with choice. Love requires, agape requires discipline. If you've been married a while, you know that the needs that you have as a guy and the needs that she has as a woman are really, really different. They're as different as night and day. And yet, what we tend to think, if we're not being intentional, is we just assume that the needs that I have, she should have, and I'll meet those needs, and it's very easy for her to think, well, the needs that I have, he should have, and I'll meet those needs. And I can tell you, that's a terrible assumption. You are going to have two very, very disappointed people. Gentlemen, there are lots of times where on a Saturday morning, out of 100 things you'd rather do, the loving thing to do is to go out in that garage and clean it up. Not because you have such joy in cleaning a garage, but because that's going to mean something to her. It will mean nothing to you, maybe until you're done. But it will mean a whole lot to her. And ladies, at the end of a day when a husband has needs, his needs are not the same as yours, and for you, though you might have 100 different things that you would rather do, making love to your husband might be the most important thing you do for him. It doesn't matter, again, about my needs. Is love says, what are the greatest needs I can meet in my spouse, and I'm going to give myself to those as a priority. That's discipline. Matthew says, so in everything do to others what you would have them do to you, for this sums up the law and the prophets. Now let me mention a few love killers. Expecting love to do too much is a love killer. Here's a song that illustrates this very thing.
God only knows what I'd be without you. If you should ever leave me, life would still go on, believe me. The world could show nothing to me. So what good would living do me? God only knows what I'd be without you.
If you walk out, later on he says, what good would living do me? Now, girls, I will tell you, those are flattering words to hear. But if a guy ever tells you those words and means them, there's one thing you should do. Run! Run! Get the heck out of Dodge! Get the heck as far away from that guy! My life is such a mess. I don't see how it could come together. But I finally met you, and now it's coming together. What would I do without you? Run! You are signing up for a lifetime of misery. What you want to find as you think about getting married, you don't want somebody that is so needy they have to have marriage or they have to have you. You want the opposite of that. You want to find somebody that's already happy. It's already secure. One of the things that I really loved about Mindy when we were dating was I knew she didn't need marriage to be happy. She was going to be a single woman and happy as a single woman no matter what. She didn't need me in her life to be happy or to be joyful or content. That was a very powerful reason why I was very interested in her. And thankfully, after all these years, she still really doesn't need me to be happy and content. Number two, love cannot make you feel secure. Let's run with our next song. Girls, if a guy ever sings that song to you, what should you do? Run as fast as you can. I am so needy. I need your love. I guarantee you there's going to come a time in your marriage where that person is going to blame you because they don't feel loved. If that's not happening in their life before they get married, after they get married, their life gets harder. There's more pressure, more deadlines. Life doesn't get easier. And if they're not happy single, I guarantee you they're not going to be happy married. Number three, love will make my life come together. Let's hear our last song here. Even our young kids know this song. Are considered love songs in our culture. And I can't think of, if I tried to sit down and think of the anti-love lyrics, I couldn't come up with better ones than these. These are as self-serving and self-centered songs as you could write. what the fellow that sang My Girl is going to discover is that there are days where he has cloudy days and stormy weather, and so does his wife. And suddenly, My Girl isn't going to be able to come along and blow the clouds out and bring the sunshine to make sunny weather. In fact, sometimes, singer's going to look for My Girl and see a tornado coming. Present company excluded. Who's teaching today? On the back of your handout, I want to wrap this up. Some of you know me pretty well. Some of you don't know me all that well. I want to just give you a little few pictures. This will become clear in a few minutes why this is important. When I was in junior high, I was the shortest kid in my class. Not just my class, my grade. Not just my grade, junior high. Just a little bitty guy. And I was as skinny as a rail, and I had a huge head. Think of pumpkin on a toothpick. When I was in fifth grade, my football coach, who was 6'4 and played professional football, could wear my helmet. I had buck teeth. I looked like a beaver. Except they weren't pointed down this way. They were sort of pointed out this way. Now, you don't have that today because in our culture now, you go to the orthodontist when you're young, and they kind of fix all that stuff in stage one. That's that first $3,000 payment. And then you go to stage two for the second $3,000 payment. Being short, skinny, big head, and buck teeth were not in my youth group. I don't know about our youth group, but in my youth group, they weren't in. And it wasn't in at school. I had curly hair. Curly hair was not in my day. I remember going out sometimes into the downstairs and ironing my hair before I went to school. Sometimes I went out when it was hot and we had the air conditioner on. I went outside, this is before blow dryers, and blew dry my hair with the air conditioning vent coming up, you know, out of the ground this way to try to get straight hair. It was not a pretty picture. Now, those things are not deal breakers. Some of you have gone through things that are much more difficult than that, but I can tell you that on the inside, there was sort of a quiet humiliation that I carried around with being me. I just didn't feel very manly. I wanted to be a man. I wanted to be one of the guys. I wanted to be tough. But every time I looked in the mirror, I kind of laughed because it seemed like there were a whole bunch of things mitigating against that. Now, fast forward to grad school. 24, 25 years old, I meet Mindy. And I'm going to be a little facetious here. There's much more to this story than I have time for. But Mindy liked my hair. She liked my head. She liked my teeth. Most importantly, when I was around her, I felt like a man. I felt manly. Not like the guy on the screen. Fast forward again. I propose. She accepts. Fast forward again. We're standing at the altar, getting ready to say our wedding vows to one another. Now, what was I supposed to have said on that day? What was I supposed to have said? What I was supposed to have said, at least in my head and in my heart, was something along these lines. God, because of what you've done for me, I am complete in you. I am made in your image. Jesus Christ died for me, and I am valuable. I am important. And that forms an iron-tight identity that nothing else can mitigate against or destroy. Because Jesus Christ loved me and gave himself up for me, then I can do that same thing for this woman I'm about to marry. And because that love that you've sacrificed for me, I want to give that to her as the central agenda in what I'm going to do in this wedding. Nothing more important than being other-centered as I try to build this marriage. And that's what I was supposed to have said. Now, what do you suppose Mindy was supposed to have said? She was supposed to have said something like, "You know, God, I am a woman, and sometimes it's painful living in this world because sometimes there's a lot of rejection and a lot of hurt feelings, and sometimes I don't feel all that loved by the people around me. I wish I did, but you died for me, and all my sins have been forgiven, and I've been washed clean, and I am a princess to you. And that forms my core identity. And because I've tasted something of your love for me, your special, delightful love in me, then as the central agenda of my marriage, I am going to extend that same delight you have for me to my husband who's standing here." Now, that's what she was supposed to have said. It's not what she said. And it's not what I said. What I said will probably not surprise you given the little pieces that I've given you. I think my heart was saying something like this. You know, I'm standing here getting ready to get married, and as I think back about my life, in a lot of ways it's kind of stunk being me. Curly hair, big head, little toothpick body, shortest guy, buck teeth, all these things going against me. And I also, I've always looked younger than people think I am. I'd always hoped nobody would ask me how old I am, although you can do that now. How old I am. And I just never felt all that manly. Sometimes the girls that I dated, I'd feel a little bit more of that. But I think I found the solution to my problems. I think I found a way to hurt not nearly as much. There she is. Now, woman, you need to understand something. I will love you. I will be there for you. I will try to meet all your needs. But let's get one thing clear. I will do all of those things as long as you make me feel important as a man, sort of like you did when you came out and watched my softball games, or sometimes when we're just talking, or you see me do something really well, and you just kind of melt. Woman, that's your assignment. Will you take it? I hope you will. I'm signing up for a lifetime of you meeting that need. That's probably what I was really saying. And what she was saying was probably something like this. I grew up in a house that love wasn't expressed all that much. I had two brothers and a dad, and they none of them were all that sensitive. And my dad seemed to be away at work a lot, into his job a lot, and there was a lot of anger and conflict in our family. I really don't remember my dad or anybody really pursuing me as a woman, and I really longed for that. I miss that. A few boyfriends would do that in high school and a few in college. But suddenly Seth shows up. And it seems like he likes pursuing me. He likes spending time with me. He likes listening to me. And wow, I think I'm signing up for that deal. So listen, buddy, how you made me feel as a woman, it's your mission to do that the rest of our life. Here's the pen and paper. Are you willing? That's probably what she said, down deep. That's not a pretty picture. I call this sort of the tick on a dog marriage. Just think about that. What's the purpose of the tick? What's the mission of the tick? To bless the dog? The tick says, I am here, I'm going to find a host somewhere, and when I do, I'm going to take my mandibles, my teeth, and dig them into your flesh, and I'm going to suck out all the juice that I need to feel better about me. Of course, the problem is, the other person is also a tick. And they're going to expect that you're going to give to them to fill them. In essence, what you have at virtually every marriage is two ticks and no dog. The Bible calls this sin. It calls it self-centeredness. It calls it evil. It calls it wicked. If I'm going to do this, I have got to come into contact with a very different resource for my needs being met than even a really, really, really neat woman. And that's what the Bible tells us to do. Why spend money on what is bread, what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen to me and eat what is good. Your soul will delight in the richest of fare. There are other resources available that I need. And part of these resources is the real deal here. And when I get a taste of that real deal in my life, then I have a chance, however much God chooses to put in here at any given moment, but I have a chance to do for my wife something that she will get nowhere else. Let's pray together. Father, we are a mess. The Bible says that we are sinners by nature. We do these things without even having to think about it, without even having to plan it. We just are ticks. And we thank you that Jesus Christ died for us to make it possible to change this very element that is alive in every marriage, whether we're aware of it or not. Help us to repent, to turn away from expecting, demanding, requiring our spouse to come through for us, and turning to you as the ultimate resource of what my soul most longs for. And then help us to give our spouse a taste of what we receive from you. And help that to become more and more important in our hearts.